disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
The following subject has taken me almost 12 months to research and investigate. The subject matter has taken me down many rabbit holes and dead-end alleys of disinformation, but I have finally arrived at a point where I can share the evidence and facts that I have found with you all. There are a lot of details and moving parts to this case, so this is why this will be a multiple-part series, the entirety of which will drop over the next 3 weeks. If you enjoy what you hear and you'd like to support us, please consider heading over to patreon.com/deadsouls and donating to our research and investigations. Thank you. This is Chapter 1, The Beginning. It was 11 p.m, October the 12th, 1974. The sky was clear, and there was a slight easterly breeze that cooled the 18 degrees Celsius temperature that night. The campus at Stanford University was alive with the sounds, smells, and sights of Saturday night. The thump, thump, thump of reverberant bass guitars drifted in the air from parties and bars in the near distance. Football fever gripped the campus. Stanford, even though known for its academic excellence, was in the midst of a sports resurgence. The pride of Jim Plunkett's Stanford Indians' success on New Year's Day in 1971, even though four seasons prior, still burned in the hearts of the student body. It was mid-October, Columbus Day weekend. While the eastern and northern states were in the throes of autumnal dry leaves and ripening pumpkins in the countdown to Halloween, it was a clear, pleasant, second summer halcyon evening in Palo Alto. There were many such nights in the friendly, laid-back atmosphere of California's Silicon Valley. In fact, the whole of Santa Clara County gave a welcoming and pleasant vibe. It was affluent, dreamy, and very peaceful. The area of Palo Alto and nearby San Jose was, and still is today, home to a considerable number of high-tech and innovative corporations. IBM, Apple, and later Google and Facebook had all laid their roots and headquarters there. You see, Stanford University and other such local institutions were regarded as hallmarks of philosophical liberalism, but the valley it's located in itself is often considered a refuge of conservative morals and politics. This sometimes is surprising when compared to the raucous and extremely liberal northerly neighbor San Francisco, or the flamboyance and exuberance of Los Angeles to the south. In 1974, 19-year-old Bruce Perry was a second-year med student at Stanford. Bruce was dedicated to his studies. He was focused and hardworking, but that's not to say that Bruce was always serious. He did have his moments. But for the immediate future, they seemed as long ago and far away as his hometown of Bismarck in North Dakota. To all who knew Bruce, he was an all-American boy from a very much all-American town, whose family nurtured him with a Norman Rockwell Americana upbringing. The son of a wealthy dentist, Dr. Duncan Perry, the attractive, curly-haired Bruce was a standout in both the classroom and sports field in his hometown of Bismarck. His days at Bismarck High School had been alive and full, and when he graduated in 1973, he left a legacy of being somewhat of a track and field star in North Dakota. Bruce was popular, deeply religious, and participated in the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. And since August 17, 1974, Bruce was a married man. His blonde bride, who was also 19 and from the same town as Bruce, was his high school sweetheart, the former Arliss Dykeman. Also deeply religious, a devout Christian, Arliss had joined Bruce in Stanford following their marriage 3 months before. Arliss busied herself around the couple's small but cozy corner apartment on the second floor of the university's Quillen Hall, a residence for married students, but was not a student at the university herself. Just before 11:30 on October the 12th, Alice gathered up some letters she had written to family and friends back home in Bismarck and told Bruce she was going out to post them. Even though it was late and the mail wouldn't be collected until Tuesday, given the Columbus Day holiday, Alice wanted to get out and do something. Bruce decided to pack up his work and get outside for a short while himself. He could see that Alice was restless and that he hadn't done very much to liven up the evening by working throughout. Bruce felt he should devote more time to Alice. Alice was a vision of Middle America. A studious young woman, she was a high school cheerleader. A trusted friend and confidant to many that knew her, Alice was pretty, small in stature, with a warm smile, an inquisitive nature, and a strict obedience to the teachings of the Lord. She had shoulder-length blonde hair, wore glasses, and Alice would often take long walks around the campus to fill her days. And just like her husband, she belonged to the Fellowship of Christian Athletes back in Bismarck. Down in Stanford, she joined Young Life, a student evangelical society. The members of the group taught Sunday school, studied the Bible, and strove to spread the message of God to the masses. Make no mistake, when it came to God and her faith, she was consistent, outgoing, and a dedicated missionary. That said, she was friendly, approachable, and very kind-hearted. Alice and Bruce tied the knot in a lavish wedding ceremony held in the Bismarck Reformed Church on August 17, 1974. Then, after a week's honeymoon in a rural cabin owned by Alice's parents, it was on to Stanford as Mr. and Mrs. Bruce Perry. Initially, Alice had trouble adapting to her new life in Stanford. She had no friends, no job, and her days were long and uneventful. But on October the 1st, Alice's boredom would melt away when she was hired as a receptionist at a Palo Alto law firm. The additional income would also ease the financial strain that the couple felt too. In her free time, she often stopped by to pray at the large and ornate Stanford Memorial Church. Bruce, when his schedule allowed, would also accompany her there too. Whilst Alice liked her surroundings in Stanford, she would also comment in letters to friends back home of the pronounced lifestyle differences between Dakota and California. In one such letter, she stated, "Nobody here is very personal at all. They don't even say hello when you ride up the elevator with them." Make no mistake, Alice felt daily that she was a long way from home. Her hometown of Bismarck was classic America. It was ruggedly beautiful and both simple and remote. The crime rate was very low, and that gave life in Bismarck somewhat of an innocence. Alice, like many people there, may have appeared somewhat naive compared to the folks of the inner cities, or those on either of the seaboards at the time. That said, even though the crime rate in Bismarck was low, there were still young people who would dabble with drugs and liquor, and given the specific time period, experiment in various esoteric beliefs and New Age ways of living. That Saturday night at around 11:30 p.m, both in good spirits, the young couple, Bruce and Alice, strolled from the high-rise campus apartment building to the mailbox. The couple were deep in conversation on their walk, although they soon suddenly began to argue. A tire on their car was slowly losing air and deflating, and each thought that the other should have filled it. The argument was stupid, they both thought so, yet it happened. The bickering continued as they strode in the direction of the Memorial Church, which loomed before them in the distance. It was now around 11:40 p.m. Alice stopped abruptly, turned to face Bruce, and told him that she wanted to be alone. The argument had pissed her off, and she told her husband that she was going to visit the church. She told Bruce that she would see him later, at the apartment, and that he should go home. Equally annoyed, Bruce turned and stormed off across the campus. He didn't notice whether anyone was watching him. At around 11:50 p.m, Alice Perry pulled open the huge doors of Stanford Memorial Church and went inside. The church was grand and imposing. There were rich velvet tapestries of red and purple, and montages, sculptures, and candelabra of immaculately polished, glistening gold. Above it all was a magnificent golden dome. Alice was very fond of the church and thought its interior was beautiful. As Alice entered, there was an elevated area with several steps leading up to the floor of the church, directly in front of the main altar. To either side of the altar, there were rounded alcoves which contained additional pews, all angled to face the main altar. The building sort of resembled a thick, three-leafed clover from above, with the altar alcove in the centre. The church, as always, would be locked up at midnight by the campus security guard, Stephen Crawford, a familiar face around campus. When Arliss entered the church, there were two other worshippers sat in a silent vigil of prayer. These young people, who occupied a pew to the right of the centre aisle, in the rear of the church, noticed Arliss in the subdued lighting as she softly walked down the male aisle and eased her way to one of the front rows on the left. She knelt and began to pray. Arliss at the time struck a casual look and was wearing a dark brown jacket, a blouse, blue jeans and a pair of beige wedge-heeled shoes. Meanwhile, Bruce had returned to the couple's apartment. He was still dwelling on the altercation with his wife. He expected that Arliss would be home soon and that they would talk and reconcile over their silly argument. After all, they had had worse before, and I'm sure they would have worse in the future, but it was nothing compared to the strength of their relationship. Back at the church, as Arliss prayed, it soon became midnight and the two worshippers behind her rose to leave. It was closing time. Looking over their shoulders as they departed, they saw that Arliss hadn't moved from her pew. She was now alone in the grandiose house of worship. Outside the church, a passerby spotted a young man who was about to enter the building. He was casually dressed. He had sandy-coloured wavy hair which was parted on the left. He was of medium build and wore a royal blue short-sleeved shirt. He appeared to be around 23 to 25 years of age. For some reason, the witness noted that the man wasn't wearing a watch. Security guard Steve Crawford was a few minutes late when, at 12:10 a.m, he stood in the rear of the church, looked for stragglers, and saw none. Crawford shouted into the empty, dimly lit church, "We're closing for the night. The church is being locked for the night now. If anyone is here, you have to leave." There was no response. No sound, just the echoes of Crawford's voice carrying throughout the building. In particular, there was no sign of Arliss or the sandy-haired stranger. The church was empty. Satisfied all had left the building, Crawford shut the doors, locked them, and walked away. At about the same time, Bruce Perry was nervous. He thought more and more about the argument with his wife, and he was increasingly annoyed that he had left her alone on the campus at midnight. He was getting more and more restless at just waiting for her to come home. Eventually, he had ruminated on the issue to the point that he couldn't stay put any longer, and he headed back out, hopefully to meet with Arliss on her way back home. Bruce knew that the church closed at midnight and was less than half a mile away from their apartment, so he would definitely bump into her on her way home, he thought. Bruce was puzzled and slightly concerned. It was now 12:15 a.m. and he was stood in front of the darkened and locked up church. Where was Arliss? Why hadn't he seen her on his way over? He walked around to the side entrance. It was also secured. And then around to the rear of the building. But she wasn't there either. And again, everything was locked up there too. Secure. Tight. Bruce then decided to comb the campus and see where Arliss had got to. She must be around somewhere. It's impossible she could have got lost. She knows the area well, even though she was new to the area. And the apartment was so close. Bruce was fine. Arliss was fine, he convinced himself. He was sure he would find her. A passerby would later say that he thought he heard some noise inside the church at around 12:20 a.m. in the vicinity of the choir loft. But he shrugged it off and kept walking, he told police. Bruce's search of the campus was futile. He was grown increasingly anxious, and he abandoned the search and returned to Quillen Hall. Hopefully, Arliss would be there, he thought. But Arliss wasn't there. He knew that Arliss didn't know anyone at Stanford yet, so she couldn't have just dropped by a friend's house or one of the many campus parties that were happening that night. No, Bruce thought. But he waited and worried. Maybe, he thought, She was more annoyed at the argument that they had had. And she needed a longer walk to cool down, so maybe she had taken a longer route home. At 2 a.m., on his next series of rounds, security guard Steve Crawford again checked the church. He tried all the locks and assured himself they were locked. He said later that he also walked through the building, as he was supposed to as part of his job role, and he saw and heard nothing inside. At 3 a.m., Bruce finally had enough of waiting and picked up the telephone. He called the Stanford security and reported his wife missing. He told the dispatcher that Alice might have been asleep in the church and been locked inside. Stanford security immediately escalated the incident to police officers, who went directly to the church to check for Alice. The police stated that they examined the church's outer doors and found them to be locked securely. The police, however, didn't go inside, which was the only way to learn if someone had indeed fallen asleep in one of the pews, surely. If they had just gone inside, they would have met the killer of Alice Perry. This is because when Crawford next returned to the church at 5:30 a.m, a door on the right side of the building was forced open. It was forced from the inside. His discovery suggested that someone broke out of the church after 3 a.m., after the visit by Stanford police officers. The time of Alice's death would be fixed at approximately midnight, however. When Crawford entered the church at 5:30 a.m., slowly and nervously, and in the faint light, he quickly scanned the interior to determine if anything valuable had been stolen. Nothing appeared to be disturbed, so Crawford, again slowly and warily, walked around the perimeter aisle, peering apprehensively into the pews. Crawford was nervous that whoever broke the locks on the side door might still be in the building. It was then that he discovered the missing Alice Perry. He wished he hadn't. It was a vision from hell. Alice's body was lying on its back, with the body partially under the last pew on the left-hand side alcove, a short distance from where she was last seen praying. Above her was a large carving which had been sculptured into the church wall years before. It was an engraving of a cross. The symbolism was explicit. A church official who later viewed the scene stated that the site was ritualistic and satanic in nature. Alice's head was facing forward toward the main altar. Her legs were spread wide apart, and she was nude from the waist down. The legs of her blue jeans were spread-eagled upside down across her calves, purposefully arranged in that manner. Viewed from above, the resulting pattern of Alice's legs and those of her inverted blue jeans made a diamond-like shape. Alice's blouse was torn open, and her arms were folded across her chest. Placed neatly between her breasts was an altar candle. Completing the desecration, another candle, 30 inches long, was jammed into her vagina. Alice had been beaten and choked. However, none of this had caused her death. Alice Perry had died from an ice pick which had been rammed into her skull behind her left ear. Its handle protruded grotesquely from her head. The police were careful at the time not to release any details of the murder to the public. Stephen Crawford was gagging at the grotesque sight, retching. He fled the empty church and summoned his superiors in an emotional phone call. They called the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Department, who responded immediately. A team of officers and six detectives attended the scene. Under-Sheriff Tom Rosa, while reviewing the body, quickly characterized the slaying as the work of a sexual psychopath. As the officials secured the church, other detectives went to the Perry apartment, believing, logically, that Bruce was a primary suspect in the murder. When Bruce opened the front door to the police, he was nearly arrested on the spot, and not without reason. Bruce Perry was covered with blood at the time. The horror-stricken Perry was told of his wife's death and questioned about the events of that night. Through tears and hysterics, Bruce tried to convince the detectives that the blood on his shirt was his own. Bruce explained that he was prone to nosebleeds when he was upset, and he said that his anxiety about Alice set off a particularly bad nosebleed that night. He pleaded with the police, who were skeptical initially. Bruce would go on to take a polygraph test, and also a check of the blood type on his shirt would soon confirm it was indeed his own blood. As mentioned, the police withheld the information pertaining to the murder from the public, not only because of the revolting violation of the victim, but also so the police could eliminate potential false confessions and identify those with true knowledge of the incident. It was surprising, police would say, how often false confessions were made by members of the public, especially in high-profile cases, which this incident was likely to be. In a few hours, the Sunday service was scheduled to take place at the church, but not this Sunday, at least not inside the church, which was now a crime scene. Police and coroner's investigators poured through the location, looking for something, anything, any clues or evidence that could lead them to the killer. There was a strong occult vibe to this murder, police thought. Alice's body was finally rolled out on a gurney around 10:15 a.m. by a silent coroner's investigator. Media, police, church congregation, and curious, shocked students amassed outside the church that morning. Voices were hushed, with only an occasional police radio crackling to disturb the silence. A church service was actually conducted outside the church that morning by Reverend Robert Hamilton Kelly. He was dean of the church, and he wasn't going to let evil triumph, he stated. At 4:30 that afternoon, the interior of the church would be turned back to God as Fathers John Duryea and Robert Gilgare celebrated a Roman Catholic Mass, which began with a blessing to reclaim Stanford Memorial from the forces of evil. The Santa Clara Sheriff's Department officers were directed towards a hunt for a local sexual psychopath. The list of possible subjects at the start of the investigation were Bruce Perry and security guard Steve Crawford, understandably. Ranked behind them was the unknown sexual psychopath, who most probably was the sandy-haired young man seen entering the church around midnight. FBI technicians in Washington, D.C. lifted a perfect palm print from the candle found in Alice's vagina. That discovery finally eliminated Stephen Crawford and Bruce Perry as possible suspects from the police investigation, and eventually inspired the police to fingerprint more than 100 other individuals, ranging from students and university employees to known sexual deviants in the area. And yet, the biggest clues eluded them. A memorial to Alice Perry was held on October the 15th in the very same church in which she met her demise, something that Bruce Perry felt particularly difficult to deal with. As the sorrowful throng waited for Bruce, his father, and his uncle to file out after the service, one of the acquaintances that Alice had managed to make in the 6 weeks of her California life was startled. Mark Connors was looking at Bruce, and something was very wrong. Bruce Perry wasn't who he was supposed to be. You see, Mark Connors worked at the Palo Alto law firm Spaeth, Blaze, Valentine & Klein. It was where Alice was hired as a receptionist just 2 weeks before her death. In the church, Connors strained for a close look at Bruce. He then approached him outside and expressed his sympathy and condolences. He then knew for sure that Bruce Perry was not the man he believed was Bruce Perry. Later that day, after the service, Connors contacted the sheriff's office. He recounted a dramatic event from the afternoon of Friday, October the 11th, the day before Alice was killed. Connors recalled, it was noon and Alice was sat behind her reception desk. A visitor arrived to see her. Connors assumed it was Bruce Perry, since Alice was new in California and had stated to not meet in any friends yet. Who else would know where she worked? Connors watched as Alice and the young man engaged in a 15-minute conversation that he described as serious and intense. He thought that Alice might have been angry at Bruce for coming to the office so soon after she was hired. Regardless, he decided, Bruce was a nice-looking young man who seemed to be in his early 20s. He was wearing jeans and a plaid shirt and was husky, broad-shouldered and athletic-looking. He stood about 5 feet 10 and had curly, blondish hair of regular length. He certainly wasn't a hippie. When the young man left, Alice resumed her duties. She said nothing to Connors or anyone else about the visitor, leaving him with the impression that the young bride's husband dropped by unannounced to settle a pressing matter. It wasn't until the memorial service that Connors realized that he hadn't seen Bruce Perry at all. The detectives took down the information and asked Bruce if he had stopped by the law firm. Bruce confirmed he hadn't, and Bruce further advised the investigators that Alice had specifically asked him not to call or visit there until she had settled into her job. She hadn't mentioned the visitor to Bruce either, Bruce told the police. Well, the detectives asked, does this man sound like anyone you would know? Bruce Perry shook his head. No, it certainly didn't. The police disregarded this fact in their single-minded quest for a random sex pervert. Even though the description of Alice's visitor was similar to that of the man seen entering the church after her at midnight. Surprisingly, they didn't assign a police artist to draw sketches of the two men for comparison or identification purposes either. So that leaves the lingering questions. Who was this man at the law office? Who knew Alice was in California? Who knew where she worked? Could the killer have been from Bismarck? Is it possible the slaying wasn't the work of an area psycho after all? Could Alice have actually known her killer? Could the killer have known her family, or Bruce's, who were among the few who did know that Alice had recently found employment? Or could the killer have just known that she was at Stanford, followed her around until he learned where she worked, and then dropped in on her? And why did he materialize only a day before her death? There was no question that the killer had murder on his mind and that the incident was pre-planned. The killer carried the ice pick into the church. It certainly wasn't a weapon of opportunity. But none of these questions were asked or pursued by the police. As the police started their search, Bruce took Alice's body back to Bismarck. The Bismarck Reformed Church, where the couple had been married only 2 months before, was the site of the funeral on Friday, October the 18th. Around 300 friends, relatives, former schoolmates and acquaintances attended the church service. Virtually everyone who had attended the wedding to wish Alice a happy life gathered again to see her laid to rest. There is even a chance that someone involved in the murder was sat amongst them. Around 2 weeks after Alice's funeral on Halloween 1974, Alice Perry's temporary gravestone was stolen. Police involved in her murder investigation dismissed the incident as random vandalism by a sick individual who thought it was a joke or some weird collector of morbid artifacts. This seems an unusual assumption from the police given that two other trophy items were taken from Alice's body during the murder, items which have never been released to the public. Police should have at least investigated the theft of the gravestone, but they didn't. Further, shortly after the funeral of Alice, Bruce's parents would contact the Stanford police. They had heard a rumour floating around town in Bismarck that they thought might be relevant to the murder case. The rumour was that when Alice was living in Bismarck, and shortly before she married Bruce and left for California, that her and a friend from a local church group had ventured to a nearby town named Mandan. Their purpose for going was to make contact with a local cult group that they adhered was based there and to try and convert them to Christianity. The cult, it was rumoured, was said to have been satanic in its beliefs. The Santa Clara detectives were 1,700 miles from Bismarck and they didn't have the manpower or budget to conduct an investigation in North Dakota. Plus, they still strongly believed that the killer was a local sexual predator, an opportunistic monster who was not acquainted with Alice prior to her murder. Whilst the Stanford police, with the help of Bismarck authorities, did look into the rumours, they would soon dismiss them as having nothing to do with Alice's murder. The rumour did, however, turn out to be true, and Alice had attempted to convert a satanic cult into the ways of Christianity. A number of friends of hers confirmed this had happened. Police, however, didn't feel the need to speak with the cult regarding their comments. As time went on, the murder of Alice Perry slowly disappeared from news columns, and the incident slipped into obscurity. It became an open but inactive case within the Sheriff's Department. Bruce Perry would eventually graduate from Stanford and became a professor of psychiatry. He is the senior fellow of the Child Trauma Academy in Houston, Texas. He has served as a consultant and expert witness on many high-profile incidents involving traumatized children, including the Columbine High School massacre, the Oklahoma City bombing, and the Waco siege. Bruce has touched base with the Stanford police every 6 months over the years for updates on the murder case, but movement and developments have been minimal. Bruce has never remarried. It sounds like this is the end of the journey at this point. Like the case is stuck in limbo and the perpetrator got away with their crimes. It also sounds like this is a simple murder case, another unsolved atrocity from the archives. Once again, however, the questions remain. Who is the man that came into Alice's place of work and had a heated discussion with her prior to her murder? Was he the same person who witnesses saw outside the church just prior to Alice's murder? Their descriptions sure seem similar. Is it fair and realistic to expect police to take their investigation to Bismarck knowing that Alice knew no one in Stanford? Ultimately, if the trail of the suspects does lead back to Bismarck, then who could have possibly wanted to kill Alice Perry? In the next episode.
For almost a year, New York police have been working with at least five drawings of the .44 caliber killer who calls himself Son of Sam. He was generally described as white, between 20 and 35 years old. Now Son of Sam has a new face, a police drawing which is described as the most accurate eyewitness resemblance so far.
Until then, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. Visit deathcult.com for more information on how you can help us and support our broadcasts. There you can also find links to our socials, Patreon, and episodes. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.
The devil means business.